I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Taiwan has a new broom, new look, independent-minded president, Chen Shui-bian, who's going to make the rhetorical contortions around this old one-China formula a lot more interesting and maybe even hazardous. Mainland China had huffed and puffed that a vote for Mr. Chen against the split good old Nationalist Party was a vote for war. The bullying must have built the upset bigger, though nobody's talking about war anymore, especially Mr. Chen. Mr. Chen's whole career as a lawyer, then as a reformed mayor of the city of Taipei, has been built on a conviction that there ought to be two different countries, sovereign nations across the Strait of Taiwan. But he has also said that only a military provocation by mainland China would prompt him to do anything about it, since Taiwan is used to enjoying full sovereignty anyway, and enjoying a democracy that's capable, after all, of electing him against the odds. Connection listeners, should we be savoring a democratic surprise in Taiwan? Or should we be fretting about a quagmire for American policy? Or maybe both? Our Taiwan Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Mary Kay Magstad is in our studio. She was NPR's China reporter. She's on a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard this spring, but she's covered three elections before this in Taiwan. The New York Times man in Taipei, Eric Eckholm, will join us by phone. But join the conversation, Connection listeners, at 1-800-423-8255. Mary Kay Magstad, explain what's going on. What did people think they were voting for in Taiwan over the weekend?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that they were voting for reform. They are sick of the corruption of the Kuomintang Party. It's not so much a vote for independence. I think a lot of Taiwanese are much more careful than that. And they realize that if they go for a flat-out confrontation with China, that could provoke some sort of an attack. The Chinese have said repeatedly, and they seem to mean it, that if Taiwan ever formally declares independence, China will attack. It's a very emotional issue in China. It's something that, you know, no matter who you ask, they'll say the same thing. So even Chen Shui-bian himself has backed off from his earlier very pro-independence statements. And now he says, look, we want to work out a way to coexist with China.
Reform vote and a local vote. As Tip O'Neill and Confucius say, all politics is local. But what does that mean in local terms? What does reform mean?
Well, the Kuomintang Party over the course of the last few decades has been known for having an incredible business empire worth about $3.8 billion. They have a stake in something like 100 different companies. They have ties with the local mafia and with business interests. And Chen Shui-bian is sort of like Taiwan's Mayor Giuliani. I mean, when he was the mayor of Taipei, he really cleaned up the city. He cracked down on corruption. He cracked down on prostitution. I think locals were quite impressed with that aspect of what he can do in office.
So he's Rudy Giuliani. I had thought they say he's as stiff as Al Gore, but he also had this kind of John McCain insurgency about him. This is just a start, but we're going to get to know this man. Eric Eckholm joins us by phone from Taipei. He's the New York Times correspondent from China and in these elections. Eric, why so much anger in the aftermath this morning?
Well, I think there's been a building resentment of President Li Donghui for some time, ironically from within his own party. All of the people who were out in the streets shouting things or stoning cars yesterday were lifelong KMT members of the Nationalist Party.
And why are they angry at Mr. Li?
They feel that he, through his own ego and perhaps dishonesty, has destroyed their party. He handed the election to the hated opposition, Chen Shui-bian, but he engineered things to make that happen, many of them believe. He's thought to secretly have pro-independence beliefs himself, and so a portion of his party who don't share those views have always been very suspicious of him. And in this case, he had a personal rivalry with the most popular single candidate, who is James Song, who came in second in the race. And if Mr. Song had been the nominee of the Nationalists, they would have won this election pretty easily, most people believe.
Would it make a difference, other than, you know, for the inside party folk? In other words, would a single unified Nationalist Party and a Nationalist victory over this past weekend have made a difference for the future?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this party has ruled this island for more than half a century, and it seemed to be all-powerful, and now suddenly it's all crumbling before their eyes. There's this great split. Mr. Song is forming his own party, which probably will be larger than the Nationalist Party. You're going to have this ironic situation where, as Mary Kay mentioned, they have billions of dollars worth of assets. They're the richest party in the world, probably, and they could well end up 6 months from now being the number three small party in a small island. You know, it's just the entire world is crumbling for some of these people.
Does the crumbling Nationalist Party not get a lot of the credit, though, for not only for moving out of office as they will, but for a belief in the elections that came to fruition yesterday?
Oh, definitely. President Lee, I think most people, even those who are screaming at him now, will agree that he played an important role in the democratic transition towards elections. And there hasn't been any talk here about sort of undoing the election. And there was nobody screaming against Chen Shui-bian. You know, he won. The anger was all at Lee for, in their view, was kind of screwing things up for the nationalists.
Eric, what do you think people thought they were voting for when they made Mr. Chen president here? Mary Kay says it's essentially local reform, but it obviously has international implications. There were international threats hanging over it. What do you think people, put yourself in the mind of a voter, what were they choosing here?
Well, it's hard to sort out. It's both. There is a great sort of divide within the society here between those who basically have for a long time have wanted independence and those who would rather keep things ambiguous and things as they are. And the really independent advocates, who are a minority of the society, definitely would have voted for Chen Shui-bian no matter what, and they believe in his party. But he also benefited. There's been a real rising disgust at this what's seen as the corruption of the nationalists and the failure of Mr. Lee, despite his great role maybe a decade ago in bringing democracy, to do anything about it. In fact, they call it black gold here. It's the dirty money from businesses, from gangsters and others, and bribery, vote buying. And there's some evidence that it's actually grown worse during the 1990s under Mr. Lee, and he's done nothing to stop it because that's his own political power depended on those connections. So both Mr. Song and Chen Shui-bian campaigned against this and benefited from that.
Deep down, what is Beijing think of all this, Eric Eckholm?
I think they are flabbergasted. They didn't think it would happen, and now they have to cope with what for them is a very unpleasant situation, because Chen Shui-bian has been pretty, in their view, clever recently at masking his true beliefs. Mm-hmm. And since he's been elected, he's done a very good job of avoiding anything provocative and sort of holding out olive branches. But deep down, they know that most of his supporters are never going to go for the one China principle that they hold as sacred, and they never want to return to the motherland. And so, Beijing is being quiet for now, but it remains to be seen whether they'll be willing to cooperate with him at all and sort of making him look good by talking with him even.
Do they have to do anything about this?
Well, they don't have to do anything right now, but they have sort of laid down some markers. You know, if certain lines are crossed, then they basically threatened military action, but maybe they could find ways short of that to create great tension and pressure. But I think right now they're waiting to see what he'll do next.
Eric Eckholm, thank you for joining us, and thanks for your work. Eric Eckholm of the New York Times. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Mary Kay Magstad is our guest in the studio. We're talking about the aftermath of the election upset in Taiwan over the weekend. Andrew Yang joins us from Taiwan. He runs his own security think tank in Taipei. Andrew Yang, good morning and welcome to The Connection.
Good morning.
What does this mean in international security terms?
Well, certainly the winning for Chen Shui-bian puts a lot of challenging issues for international community. Number one, whether the new elected party was seeking more international recognition that all certainly will push in the so-called the sovereignty issues on the table as well. So I think that the DPP party, as well as the newly elected Transnistria, will be more aggressive in terms of seeking international recognition, and also aggressive in terms of seeking membership for international organizations as well.
What will you expect from the United States?
Well, certainly, United States will be facing a new situation in terms of responding to Taiwan's newly elected the president's request, because he already mentioned that he will conduct a visit as a president-elect to the United States. Certainly, he will apply for a visa from state as well. Whether U.S. is going to issue a visa to the elected president, whether U.S. will receive him in official capacity, I think those are the issues that Beijing will watch carefully as well.
What can China do about sort of an independent-minded Taiwan short of war in terms of trade or fishing rights or any other kind of sort of short of war discipline? Does China have an important hand to play here?
Well, any kind of coercion short of war would be more effective and immediate, that would push the our independence in Taiwan as well, because what Beijing has perceived right now is that this is probably an inevitable trend, that people will be more and more supporting independence and less interested in unification. That is the reason why Beijing issued a white paper statement on the 21st of February, including this indefinite delay of the cross-strait unification dialogue as a precondition for the use of force. I think that the Beijing will speed up the preparation for the ultimate military action in view of the winning of the DPP.
Is this a dangerous situation, Andrew Young?
It is a challenging situation. Dangerous, perhaps not come immediately, but will certainly come in if the newly elected leadership, as well as the party, pursuing more identity for Taiwan internationally, as well as pushing the independence issue.
Andrew Young, I wish you'd stand by for some callers, if you would, with Mary Kay Magstead. Would you just give us a little short profile, Mary Kay, of what you know about this man himself, Chen Shui-bian?
Well, as I mentioned, Chen was the former mayor of Taipei, but he started in politics years before that, at least a decade earlier. And he was always known for being both a reformer and for being pro-independence. He got on the wrong side of the Kuomintang Party very early in the 80s, and he's known for having suffered a personal tragedy where his wife was hit in a traffic accident and paralyzed from the chest down, and it's widely suspected in Taipei that that wasn't just an accident.
What would have been the politics of something like that?
The Kuomintang Party has been known to act fairly severely against its opponents, particularly in the past, particularly 10, 20 years ago. You've got to keep in mind that before 1987, the Kuomintang Party was a pretty nasty authoritarian government. Excuse me. And part of the story of this election is that it shows just how far Taiwan has come and how far, in fact, the Kuomintang Party has come in allowing this kind of a transition to take place through an election. In just basically the space of 13, 14 years, Taiwan has transformed from an authoritarian state to a democratic one.
1-800-423-8255 makes the transition in Taiwan connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Qing Mun is on the line.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about how much Taiwanese want to be independent. There are many Taiwanese that I've met feel fundamentally that they are a part of China. And certainly in business terms, investment, the commercial ties are very, very close. Also, and we clearly see that some of the vote, or most of the vote, I don't know which, was anti-Kuomintang. And in fact, the One China votes were split by the division of the Kuomintang Party itself. Historically, the people and the government of Taiwan have believed and strongly asserted there's one China. And recently, however, we've seen emerging independence movements, but I don't know how large it is. I have two questions. One is, does the Constitution of Taiwan still say that it is the government of all of China? And secondly, and really like best answers I can get on this one, is what share of the Taiwanese population do we think wants independence, and how do we know what share that is?
Okay.
Well, on the constitutional question, there was a change in the early 90s where the Taiwanese government said, okay, we no longer are going to say that we're the rightful government of all of China. We're going to say that we're the rightful government of part of a divided China, and that part is Taiwan. So they're now looking at it as being like two parts of a divided Germany used to be, or two parts of a divided Korea with two sovereign governments.
So their legislature, do they still have legislators that represent provinces in mainland China, or is that gone now?
That changed in the early 90s.
Okay.
And then there are polls that are taken in Taiwan on a regular basis of, you know, how the population feels about reunification. And as of last time I checked, which was about a year ago when I was there covering the mayoral election in Taipei, about a third of the people favored independence. A larger amount, maybe 40%, said, let's just keep the status quo. And then a minority, a very small minority, said, you know, we'd eventually like to reunify with China. Those who favored the status quo weren't so much saying, you know, we want to eventually reunify with China necessarily, but we don't want to declare independence and provoke China.
Do we know anything about how it breaks down among age groups and demographic groups or business interests?
The younger the people, the more likely they are to support Taiwan remaining at least de facto independent. They just don't see a need to reunify with China. And even in among older but educated people, they say, well, you know, we could talk about this, but we don't want to reunify with China until it's got the same level of democracy and the same level of economic development as Taiwan.
Hmm. Andrew Young, do you want to comment on that, on the fundamental question about how much independence Taiwanese really want?
Well, there are many polls conducted by government departments as well, and the private companies. But according to the official figure that is conducted by many affairs council, around 25% of the Taiwanese population in favor of independence. So those who support Tsai Ing-wen and making elected among 39%, there are 25% that are the Taiwan independent supporter. The rest 14% may be from other sectors, and they are demanding for a reform of government as well. But as the American has indicated, that the younger the age, the more support for two fronts. One is in favor of the status quo, because they still felt it's a constraint for many in China. But more and more people, young people, are in favor of independence as well, especially demonstrated by the presidential campaign this time. You can see there's a growing young generation supporting Tsai Ing-wen, and there's a growing membership for TPP in terms of in favor of their independence position.
Shingman, does that do it?
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. 1-800-423-8255. The Taiwan Connection. After an important upset election over the weekend, Alan is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Morning, Alan.
I'm a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where I teach about this. I teach about cross-strait relations, and I've written about Taiwan's democratization. And I think the last caller and Mr. Young just made a critical point that needs clarification for those who don't follow this issue often. And that is, we're in a blizzard of rhetoric: independence, one China, status quo. And I wonder whether most listeners understand that Taiwan has been an autonomous state under the name of the Republic of China. We're not talking about a Chechnya situation where a group of people are seeking to break away from a state governed by another authority. On the island of Taiwan, the government has ruled there since before the establishment of the People's Republic of China. So the notion of how many people want independence is a very blurred notion. How does one distinguish independence from the autonomy that they already enjoy? Second snowball in this blizzard is the issue of one China. What does that actually mean? Does it mean one state governed by the Communist Party of China, which is probably what Beijing seeks? Or does it mean some agreement that the two sides of the Taiwan Strait, all Chinese people, will adhere to the notion, even if it's just a notion, that they are part of a single state. And finally, the status quo. During the Cold War, it was quite easy to speak of the status quo because the restraining effects of the United States and the Soviet Union were able to keep the sides apart. In the last 10 years, the status quo is no longer static. It has continually changed. And so to say that you are interested in the status quo is a bit of an ostrich effect, sticking your head in the sand and saying, we don't know what to do about this problem, so we'll do nothing.
Professor Wachman, thank you. Stand by. You've given Mary Kay a lot to chew on there.
Right. Well, certainly on the status quo, I think that's a great point. As long as there was an authoritarian government in Taiwan and an authoritarian government in Beijing, they could basically talk with each other about how they were going to work out their differences. But with every election that Taiwan has had, it's become more and more different from mainland China. Yes, as you say, I mean, since 1949, the People's Republic of China has never had sovereignty over Taiwan. So when they're talking about independence, it's a dialogue about semantics, about whether Taiwan is actually going to follow through and say, we want to have representation in the United Nations, we want to be recognized by foreign governments, we want to be our own state. Beijing uses an immense amount of its diplomatic capital trying to get other countries to diplomatically ignore Taiwan. And it's just been this game that's been played out over decades.
I wonder, Alan, does Beijing have a sort of ironic turn of mind that it can play with this one China formula as a kind of philosophical conundrum? Or are they going to want to sort of put teeth in it at some point?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. And, of course, we can't speak of Beijing as if it were a monolithic order. There is a lot of difference of opinion in Beijing between those who see the world as perhaps we see it in the West and those who are still blinded by revolutionary zeal, strong nationalistic passions, and, frankly, a desire to stay in power and not to have the status quo in the PRC tumble in the way that it just has for the KMT in Taiwan.
Hmm. Andrew Young, what does One China mean from your perspective now?
Well, One China has many phases of definition. That is the problem. I think I agree with the professor's comment and analysis over the question of the so-called independence borders and other issues here. I think that he raised a very critical issue here, because the perception for independence or the definition for one China has divided in Taiwan society. So even the poll has indicated the percentage, but the percentage doesn't indicate that the people has shared the identical perception, and that's the problem. I think that the core issue here is that there's an identity division in Taiwan in terms of the essence, the nature of the country is. I agree that the Republic of China is already established since 1912. However, that there's a disagreement with regard to what the nature of the country is. That is the essence of the identity issue. So in essence, I think Taiwan has existed for many years, identity crisis. And this crisis will continue no matter what kind of election will be taking place. I think China is also involved in this turmoil, and Beijing cannot solve this issue because Beijing doesn't provide a clear definition what is one China.
Interesting. Stand by, if you would. The phone's 1-800-423-8255, the Taiwan connection, after a very vigorous, open, democratic upset against the Nationalist Party. 1-800-423-TALK. Simon is on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Simon.
Yes, I've been following this for years. I have to think that, that from what I understand, Taipei has been for a long time looking to become a nuclear power, looking to accrue nuclear weapons. They're always listed as one of those countries trying to be a potential nuclear power. I don't think they've signed the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, if I'm not mistaken. I think that on the black market or to build their own or whatever, nuclear weapons would give them independence, obviously. I think the longer China waits, the more fear there is that this might come to pass. And I think a movement, an attack, I wish your guest would speak on this, what a conventional attack might look like. I hear reports 45 minutes the battle would be basically lost for Taipei. I'm wondering in terms of whether or not China says in the next couple of months they're going to watch what the new government does or says, and then they're going to act. I just wonder, I believe the U.S. would stay out of it. I just don't think the United States is going to go to the mat for Taiwan, and I think that the writing's on the wall.
Well, a lot of rhetoric there, as you say, Simon. Mary Kay, what? First of all, the nuclear threshold and Taiwan.
And then
the nuclear risks.
I would defer to Andrew on that question, but on whether the U.S. would get involved, I think that's a big question and something that the U.S. has to assess. There's certainly a lot of support within the House of Representatives, as was shown by an overwhelming vote last month, to give Taiwan more military support and to show that the U.S. is behind Taiwan should mainland China attack. I think it still is a big question. And also, I don't think that the battle would be over in 45 minutes. At this point, China could launch missiles at Taiwan. It could put up a blockade, but it couldn't necessarily.
We'll come back to Andrew Young and the question after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Taiwan, which mainland China thinks of as a stray province, has a new president, Chen Shui-bian, who has built his whole career on the idea of Taiwan as a separate, sovereign nation. What about it, Connection listeners? 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation with Mary K. Magstad and in Taipei, Andrew Young, who runs his own security think tank there. Andrew Young, would you just comment on this question of, first of all, nuclear weapons for Taiwan and the prospects of a shootout?
Well, as I can recall, Taiwan is already in favor of the NPT treaty, which has been initiated in the 60s. So Taiwan is continues to abide by the NPT design. However, expelled from the UN since 1971, Taiwan no longer under the NPT constraint. However, the policy is still abiding by the NPT treaty. Even under the Chiang Ching-kuo government, he renounced the development of the nuclear weapons, even though we Taiwan possessed the capability. And President Li Teng-hui, although he said at the National Assembly 1994 to 95 that we should adopt an ambiguity policy over the nuclear weapons system, but later on he renounced that statement and said that we were not developing nuclear weapons. So far, the position hasn't been changed.
And you believe him?
Well, there's going to be a change of government, and it's up to the new government whether the new government is going to follow this position or not.
Do you believe they will?
I hope they will, because that will be a escalation for China's concern as well, if Taiwan starts to develop its own nuclear weapons.
Andrew Young and Mary Kay Magstad, would you just talk a little bit about the sort of infectious spread here of a rather confident democratic spirit that you can put questions to a ballot and you can choose freely, even under sort of international threat, and pull off an upset? I mean, that to me is the sort of main showcase here. How does that play in the rest of Asia, most especially in mainland China?
I think that the people in Taiwan cherish the democracy very deeply. I think that over the years of practicing democracy, voting behaviors is becoming more and more mature. We already witnessed that there's very little foul play, and people believe there's fair and square competition after the ballot being disclosed. So I think that this is good news for Taiwan, because upholding democracy has to be, fair and square in voting behavior.
How does it play in the mainland?
Well, basically, in mainland China, Taiwan is a very emotional issue, and even Taiwanese who are interested in political reform and having more of a say in how their government is run, even mainland Chinese who are interested, will still say Taiwan has to return to the motherland. And so they don't look to these elections and say, hey, we want to do that too. Having said that, most of the villages in China have had their own local elections for more than a decade. Local villagers can choose their leaders. But what doesn't happen and what the government is resisting happening is having elections at the township, county, provincial, and national levels mm-hmm. where those leaders are chosen democratically.
So what about the simple sort of spectator impression that people can go quietly, silently, individually to the polls and throw the bums out, that you can get a new regime by voting for it? Does that play that way at all on the mainland?
It doesn't necessarily translate that way. I know that there's a growing number of educated Chinese, younger Chinese, who say, you know, really it is the time for political reform and we would like to have more of a say. And I'm sure that the Chinese leaders look at a quiet, peaceful transition of leadership in Taiwan, and that makes them nervous, because if there were an election in China, perhaps the same thing would happen to them. But you hear people talking more about economic concerns, about nationalistic concerns, than about the desire for democracy as soon as possible.
But it's interesting. You're saying that the sort of modern, even progressive, and maybe even Western-minded citizen of Beijing today looks at Taiwan and sees, first and foremost, runaway brothers and sisters.
Absolutely. And, you know, part of it is the way Taiwan is played in the mainland press. I'm looking here at the front page of the China Daily, which is the English language newspaper in Beijing, but also the Chinese language papers tend to run the same sort of copy. And on the front page is a picture of a bloodied protester outside of the Kuomintang party headquarters. And it says that the demonstrators were venting their fury at the party chairman Li Donghui because he betrayed his own party. China's media also shows fistfights in the Taiwanese legislature, which have happened over time. So it shows democracy as being a violent and not necessarily very productive thing.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255, the Taiwan connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Bob.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I have a question. Does mainland China have a naval capability of actually invading Taiwan, not a simple prospect? And an observation, the last time the Chinese said that they were going to attack somebody, they did it across the Yalu River. I have a feeling that they mean what they say when they say they're going to wage war.
Mary Kay.
It's considered at the moment that China does not have the ability to stage a successful invasion of Taiwan, but that it's building toward that capacity, and that in, you know, perhaps a decade they might have it. But Taiwan at the same time is trying to keep pace and have the sort of defense capability that could keep China at bay.
What would it take, and what are the Taiwanese defenses?
I think Andrew should answer that.
Andrew, what are the Taiwanese defenses, and where does the American fleet come in?
Well, I think that at present, the Taiwanese defense is pretty much, at the upper hand over the defending itself against the Chinese amphibious landing. We are talking about what kind of scenario in terms of a Chinese attack over Taiwan. In terms of amphibious landing, certainly China still lack of the capability, because they don't have enough ships to ferry troops to Taiwan. But in terms of a preemptive strike by missiles, they certainly possess that kind of threat, because there are more than 300 missiles deployed on the coastal provinces in Fujian and Guangdong and in Jiangxi as well. So we have to talk about what kind of scenario at hand. If China only attacked Taiwan by missiles, they certainly possess that kind of capability. If we talk about amphibious landing and occupy Taiwan, certainly their capability is still insufficient.
Interesting. Andrew Yang, stand by. 1-800-423-8255, the Taiwan connection. Bob is on the line from Newport News, Virginia.
Good morning.
Welcome, Bob.
Japan, and as I understand it, Japan took Taiwan in 1895 and held it till the end of World War II, which means that China, that the nationalists only had had Taiwan for 4 years as a while they controlled the mainland. How does this play out to the Taiwanese?
It's an interesting question. The Taiwanese, when I was there in the 60s, there were clear lines between the so-called nationalists who'd come from the mainland and the Taiwanese. How does it stand now, Mary Kay?
For years there was intense bitterness because of a massacre that started on February 28, 1947, where the Kuomintang basically started killing local Taiwanese intellectuals and for decades did not apologize for the incident or even acknowledge it. In the 50s and 60s and 70s in Taiwan, Taiwanese weren't allowed to speak their own language in school. They had to learn in Mandarin. They weren't allowed to sort of have their own Taiwanese identity. And I think the fact that Chen himself is a Taiwanese-born politician had something to do with his popularity both in becoming mayor and now in becoming president.
Is he clearly sort of emotionally and otherwise of Taiwanese stock as opposed to sort of nationalist refugee stock?
Yeah, absolutely. He was born in Taiwan to a poor family, and he basically worked hard, got through the school system, became a lawyer, and is known as being a son of Taiwan. Li Denghui as well was born in Taiwan. He was the first Taiwanese-born leader of Taiwan, and that was part of the reason for his popularity as well.
Bob in Newport News, do you want to rephrase the question from there, or have you...
No,
have you got your question
answers.
Answered?
My wondering was that people had been so far from China for so many years that when they started talking China again, that's foreigners.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there's been a merging over the course of half a century of the mainlanders who came over and the Taiwanese who are native to the island. So they're not foreigners as much, the mainlanders who came over aren't foreigners as much as they were initially, but there is such a difference in culture between mainland China and Taiwan now in terms of values. The Taiwanese really do value their democracy. They're more sophisticated in terms of their education levels and their contact with the outside world by and large, and they just don't necessarily see any advantage to them in joining mainland China on mainland China's terms, which would be as a province of China.
Hmm. Bob, thank you for the call. 1-800-423-8255. Mark is calling from Williamsburg, Virginia.
Hi.
Hello, Mark.
Yeah, I'm just calling to make a comment. I think I just heard about what I was going to say anyway, was that the Taiwanese obviously know that there's a major threat very close to them, yet they're willing to lay that, to take a stand for democracy. And I'm very impressed with that. I'm glad to see that spirit's alive and well. And I hope that maybe things like the Internet and so on will help spread that to mainland China as they see what the rest of the world's really like.
Mark, I had a lot of those same thoughts reading the news over the weekend, but I also hear from Mary Kay that we're sort of kidding ourselves that it comes from the Internet or is done in that kind of cosmic spirit. It sounds like a very locally rooted response to kind of near at hand political corruption.
Well, I think there are two things going on at the same time. That there's a desire for reform, and there's also a desire that China stop pushing Taiwan around. Both in this election and also in the 96 election, which I covered when Li Denghui won an overwhelming victory, China was saying, if you vote for this person, we're going to come back and make you sorry that you voted for this person. And that was the candidate that people overwhelmingly supported. In the case of Chen Shui-bian, he actually won by a narrow majority over James Sung. But what's interesting is that the Kuomintang candidate won, you know, only a very small percentage of the vote by comparison, like 24% or something. So they were willing.
What does the Internet, what are these international symbols of kind of a democratic spirit have to do with it? Andrew Yang, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I don't know about the message conveyed by the internet, but I think that this is the core issue here, because for many years, Li Denghui tried to solve this issue, the identity issue, because he called for the new Taiwanese, because all the Taiwanese here, majority of them, are immigrants, whether it comes from the Qing Dynasty or from the occupied territory by Japanese, or after the defeating Japan, the Mainlanders moved to Taiwan and so forth. But it's the historical results. Therefore, it's difficult for them to, you know, make clear what kind of identity they are. So there's a need for the people in Taiwan to thinking about this issue, whether they want to identify themselves as Taiwanese in general term, and also with a lot of deep Chinese culture or not, because China concerned about Taiwan is whether Taiwanese still consider themselves as Chinese or some alien nationality.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Taiwan connection. A new Taiwan. Lauren is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hello.
Hello, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
The first thing I want to say is, I don't know if people here in the States realize how emotional and how empowering this turn of the event in Taiwan has been for Taiwanese people here in the States.
Tell us about it. You say emotional and empowering.
Right. Because for the longest time, I was educated. I moved here 12 years ago, and for the longest time, we were told there can only be one way. The education system, the educational system, has been that it can only be one way. That you can think politically, and to be able to. To vote for a native Taiwanese leader, thinking I'm just bobbing here. I'm very sorry about it. It's
okay.
Just very emotional for me. And another thing I wanted to say is very interesting how my family voted. My mom, I'm from a very small family in Pingtung, and my mom voted for one party. My brother voted for another, and my nephew voted for the president-elect. And so I thought, it's very interesting.
So these are, shall we say, mixed emotions. But put your finger, if you can, Lauren, on what you mean by emotional. What's the emotion here?
Well, it's a change. It's like you say, it's a new Taiwan. And
empowering to whom?
Empowering to, I think, the younger generation that I think I belong to, in Taiwanese people. I think I'd do better if I answer questions.
Mary Kay, have you got a question?
I'm interested in what you think the younger generation in Taiwan hopes that the new president will do in terms of finessing the relationship with China?
Well, it's a very difficult issue, I think, because nobody wants turbulence. Status quo, I think, is still the preferred situation. But in the same time, we still know... I just don't consider myself a Chinese person at all. I consider myself a Taiwanese Chinese. And it's just very, I don't know anything about what goes on in China, and I don't care about it, So I don't know if that answers just the question.
Lauren, it answers a lot, and I'm very glad you sort of put... sort of the emotional content into it. 1-800-423-8255. Ed is on the line.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Welcome, Ed. Good.
Good morning. My father just got back from Taiwan not too long ago, and he, in fact, met with Li Tenghui and a number of other various interesting people on the island. He was over there with doing some conservation work, and the people who are listening, they know exactly who I am now. But the bottom line is, what he was seeing and his observation to me coming back was, these people are working very hard to build their own country, their own sense of their future, and really striving to be the best country they can be. And I don't think they, the way the observation was put to me, they don't seem to have any thought of ever reuniting with China. They don't see themselves as just a mere portion of China. They see themselves as Taiwanese, their own country, their own dynamism, their own specialness, and are very excited about it. And are working very hard to be recognized for that specialness, just as the colonies here in the United States were when we first got going. You know, it's not a whole lot different, except that they've got this looming shadow over them.
You're talking about a sort of Taiwanese identity that is all, that also incorporates the kind of independent spirit of nationalist politics.
Bingo. That's exactly, Chris. Yeah, that really is it. And they're excited about it. I mean, Lee Teng-hui, for all his quietness and all his diplomacy, there was still, what was said to me was that he is very forceful in, you know, wanting to build this country. And not just, he's not building a province, he's building a country. And, you know, is very much that kind of person. That's the spirit he approaches things with.
Mary
Kay? The leaders in Beijing certainly wouldn't call him quiet or diplomatic. They would call him a splittist and say that he's created a huge amount of trouble for the Chinese-Taiwanese relationship. I just say, you know, while I think that there is a large proportion of the population in Taiwan that does feel, yes, Taiwan is its own separate state, its own separate country, and we want to have our own sense of identity, and we want to be recognized for what we've accomplished in terms of building up our economy and building up a democracy, there are also a lot of Taiwanese, including the young man who was just on with us a few minutes ago, who might feel that way to some extent, but also realize that if they come out and say, hey, we're our own country, that they're likely to get missiles landing on Taiwan from China.
I think we were scared of the same thing when we were first independent. We had the benefit of not having a country that could lob missiles at us, but, you know, I think the same sentiment, we were still afraid as colonies that England was going to come over and hammer us, and they tried. And I think the Taiwanese may be gearing up and getting enough chutzpah together to face that the China threat down.
I think it's more subtle than that. For one thing, the British were here in the colonies when the Revolutionary War started. It wasn't a case of them being somewhere else and of the colonies having been sovereign for 50 years, which is the case in Taiwan.
No, I agree with that. I think that's true.
And second, I think the Taiwanese would be very happy to keep some sort of pageantry going in their relationship with China in terms of saying, yeah, we can talk about reunification, but, you know, we have to do it over the course of time. It might take 100 years and hope that by the time 100 years is over, that China is a very different place. And I can say, having lived in China for almost 4 years, that it's changing extremely rapidly already. And I think Taiwanese actually might be onto something there.
Andrew Young, in just one more go round, I mean, can China live not just with this sort of territorial independence in Taiwan, but after Hong Kong and Taiwan now, with these very alternative models of modern and democratic neighbors so close to home?
Well, I think that's the, I agree with Mary Kay, it's a subtle issue here, but I think that the problem here is a long-term separation between two sides that create a different kind of mentality,
yes,
and living styles and so forth. The moral separation means that less interest in the unification. And secondly, ironically, Taiwan is geographically so close to mainland China, and that enhanced Chinese bully over Taiwan. And basically, I don't think that people in Taiwan want to be imposed on everything, because they already enjoy democracy. They want to decide their own destiny, not to be imposed by somebody else.
Andrew Young, we leave it there, and we're going to get to know all of these characters better. Thank you, Andrew Young, for joining us from Taipei. Thank you, Mary Mae Magstad from NPR and the Nieman Fellowship Program at Harvard. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Legal Seafoods, presenting a specialty wine dinner on March 22nd in Park Square. Five courses will complement fine wines from F.E. Trimbach. 783-80